You are listening to The Dish on Health IT, brought to you by Point of Care Partners, a leading health IT consultancy. Each episode will feature a rotating panel of senior consultants and guests who will talk about trends and innovations in health IT, while also highlighting how organizations can leverage these advances to solve their business problems. This episode's guest is Daniel Stein, president of the Stewards of Change Institute, a nonprofit think tank and advocacy and implementation organization. Mr. Stein talks with Kenneth Kleinberg and guest co-host Ed Daniels about interoperability across healthcare and human services and the critical role of consent. We hope this episode provides some information that's helpful to you and your organization. Also, be sure to share your topic ideas with us by emailing us at podcast@pocp.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Dish on Health IT, where we break down and discuss some of Health IT's biggest trends or topics that could use more attention. And we do it through welcoming industry-leading and innovative guests. We here at Point of Care Partners are objective Health IT consultants. We work with stakeholders across the healthcare ecosystem to leverage technology to make healthcare better. I'm Ken Kleinberg, Practice Lead for Innovative Technologies, and your host. My co-host today is Ed Daniels, senior consultant here at POCP. We're excited to welcome our special guest, Daniel Stein, president of Stewards of Change Institute, a nonprofit think tank and advocacy and implementation organization. The key topic we'll be discussing today broadly is why not only is interoperability within healthcare essential, but why connecting the healthcare ecosystem with human services and community programs is so key, and how solving the complex hurdle of consent is critical to making these connections work. But before we jump into our discussion and meet our guest, Ed, would you mind briefly introducing yourself?
Hey, thanks, Ken, and it's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Ed Daniels, and I'm a health information technology consultant, have been doing that for over 30 years, and have an opportunity to work with many clients in this area. And most recently, I've been focused on the whole world of electronic informed consent. And it's been my pleasure to be working with Daniel Stein and his organization for, you know, the last several months. Thank you.
Okay, great. Now let's greet our guest, Daniel Stein, president of Stewards of Change Institute. Welcome to The Dish on Health IT. To start, could you please tell us a bit about yourself and Steward of Change Institute?
Sure. Thanks, Ken. Hello, Ed. And thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today. I'm really delighted to be sharing a little bit of what we've been doing over the last 20 plus years or so. And it's great to have an opportunity like this to be able to present more broadly than usual. So Stewards of Change is, as you said, a nonprofit. And our mission is really to cut across and to connect the various silos within the public welfare safety net programs, really health, education, social services, housing, all of those things. And we've been on that road for, you know, quite a while now, trying to work, particularly from the social services side, bringing together all of the various different actors and players in that realm. And so just a quick note, I got started in this work, as I said, about 20 years ago after a career at Kraft Foods, working in project management, and got into this somewhat serendipitously in working in California with a very large nonprofit that's focused on child welfare. And I got intrigued about how to apply some of the business practices to the nonprofit world, and in particular to children's services, which at the time and still today has a great need for better connecting of services and supports to help families that are really at risk in the community there. So it's been a long and very exciting and interesting, challenging journey along the last couple of decades to try to help connect the dots.
Okay, great. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about the history of Stewards of Change Institute. What led you to do all this work in interoperability? And you may tell us a bit about your vision for an ideal state.
Sure. So in our work with the child welfare systems originally, both in California and then subsequently with the city of New York, and the Administration for Children's Services, one of the observations we made very early on was the real disconnection between the kinds of services that families really needed and their ability to access those services. So families who were at risk of getting their children removed or were working hard to get their children replaced back with them. And this, by the way, was right after the crack epidemic. So the field was just immersed in families who had been ravaged by, I was going to say COVID, but actually it was, the crack epidemic, which was really devastating for families. You know, these families are stressed to begin with, no less when we ask them to jump through all the hurdles of becoming eligible for whether or not their health programs or behavioral health, mental health programs, or just connecting with local community service providers or housing or food providers. And looking at that universe and that world from, you know, a sort of a business vantage point, what really jumped out was how difficult it was for families to really navigate all of those challenging hurdles and the labyrinth of eligibility requirements, documentation. And of course, the duplication between these service providers was incredible. So it was, as people have often said, you know, if you wanted to design a worse system, you really couldn't, because of just the intransigence of the specifics of each of those programs made it awfully difficult. And so I really began to call the question of, well, why is this? If we're trying to help families, why are these systems so disconnected? Why hasn't there been more attempts at actually smoothing it out, thinking about business practices, really trying to align eligibility requirements and programs? And that just opened up a real plethora of questions and challenges that we've been really pursuing in a variety of ways, which I'm delighted to talk to you a little bit about, and how that really led us into this work now. It's been really a pretty consistent journey over the last 20 years or so.
That's certainly a very complex topic. Ed, you've been involved with emergency services where you got to know what you got to know very quickly. And in some cases, there is more time to be able to sort through all this information. What do you think about this vision of the Stewards of Change Institute? How do you see it evolving?
Well, as I mentioned in my intro, I've had the opportunity to work with Daniel and his colleagues for several months now. And of course, I've got a larger background, like you said, Ken, in emergency services. And I've also done a lot of consulting and work with state Medicaid programs. So I've observed firsthand from a number of different perspectives the disconnection, if you want to call it that, that Daniel's talking about, and the challenges that people have. You know, it's one thing we, as software engineers, we look at the mechanics of being able to connect systems together and being able to, you know, allow people to put in their own preferences, in this case, their own consent for sharing data, that sort of thing. But from an engineering perspective is one thing. When you sit alongside of the beneficiaries of these programs themselves, the people that are the families and the parents, it becomes a whole different matter. The challenges, like Daniel was saying, about eligibility, filling out endless reams of paperwork, a lot of times duplicate. I know how frustrated I get when I have to fill out the same form five times. So I can really resonate with what Daniel's saying. And, you know, I just wonder, Daniel, you know, how you feel we're doing as an industry at being able to tackle some of these problems.
Thanks, Ed. I'm encouraged. I'm not sure I'm delighted yet, but I'm encouraged by the recent movement. I mean, I would say the last couple of years in particular, really the health industry and the health IT industry in particular, recognizing and beginning to at least talk the talk, the impact of social factors on people's health and wellness. And certainly that has increased dramatically over the last 5, 6, 7 years, at least as we reference social determinants as a key impact on people's lives. And now there's, you know, sort of general consensus that it's where you live, learn, work, pray, and play that actually has a dominant impact on your life outcomes, you know, and your ability to function as a person and a productive individual. I'm not quite sure yet, while the health field is beginning to understand that and beginning to take steps in that direction, I think there's still some hesitancy or some uncertainty around it. I mean, healthcare is so large and it's so dominant, and there's so much money involved with it that it's, you know, it's its own universe, right? So to expand that universe into other realms that are, in their minds, their own universes, right? So we're bringing together these systems that don't have a real history of collaborating at scale, I would say that. And so while there's progress and we're beginning to see that, people are beginning to use the right language, I think there's more work to be done. But certainly right now, it feels like at least the door's open, people are interested, and it feels like systems and solutions are open-minded towards really connecting outside of the healthcare space as well.
So let's talk more about this connecting healthcare with human services, and we could start with the biggest, the Department of Health and Human Services. What type of relationship do you have with that organization and their priorities? I've heard of something called your Project Unify. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So back at the beginning of the Obama administration, I had the good fortune of being able to participate in the Affordable Care Act, where we were contractors to the administration for children and families. And at that time, under the Affordable Care Act, there was a provision that actually explicitly looked to integrate all of the development around health exchanges and the infrastructure around the Affordable Care Act with social and human services. And it's still, actually, that language is still in the rules and regs and is often referred to, actually just as recently as the last Medicaid director's letter, that reinforces the importance of that and actually the 90% of federal funding to support that kind of integration. So we were, as I said, sort of privileged to work to help translate that and to communicate that out to the states in terms of their ability to both get funding to do the work and then to support the initiatives to try to connect into the health exchanges along the way there. Now, obviously, that has been a long-term effort, and it hasn't gone as smoothly or as quickly as one would have liked, given the overwhelming challenges of implementing the Affordable Care Act and the state exchanges. But there's an opportunity there. There are certainly channels, and there are more and more states beginning to take advantage of that. When we started to look at that, one of the things that was, again, obvious was the lack of connection between the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation, CMS, Office of National Coordinator, and some of the Administration for Children and Families and some of the other social care agencies. And we were somewhat instrumental in bringing them together to really focus overall on the potential solutions. And in some ways, that has been the impetus of our work. Project Unify, which I'll describe in a bit, actually kind of grows out of that work because of, in many ways, the importance of even introducing each other, federal agencies to one another, as outrageous as that might sound, bringing them together to understand the whole person kind of approach, and then to be able to sort of trickle that down into the states and the counties and the nonprofit organizations. So there's kind of an integrating role that we've been able to play, a translator, you might say, between federal, state, local, and then the various provider sectors as well.
So Project Unify, more specifically, what can you tell us about it?
So Project Unify really grows out of a four-year initiative. We were fortunate enough to receive some substantial funding from the Kresge Foundation about 4 years ago. It's a very large foundation focused on literally the integration between health and social care. One of the few foundations, I think, nationally that actually focuses on that. And our proposal to them was to say, look, there's a real need to bring together subject matter experts from across these different fields in some concerted, ongoing way, because we're recreating the wheel all the time. People don't know what's happening in other spaces. And, you know, you go to a conference, you hear something, maybe you call somebody back and maybe you get a connection, but there's been no real locus of activity. And so we propose to develop what we've been calling the National Interoperability Collaborative, or the NIC. And the purpose of the NIC is to bring together people, subject matter experts from all of these different fields and the federal, state, and local and different programs and the public, private, and the nonprofit to begin to share what they know and to learn from one another so we can begin to really cross those boundaries. It's really hard to do something if we don't know who lives next to us, right? Or who lives down the block from us. And so the NIC got born, and we've been holding webinars and conferences over the last several years, probably have put on about 75 different webinars, many of them over right before and then during COVID. And what really grew out of that was a real desire by the participants to say, well, this is really great. It's wonderful education, really good learning. And we're able to sort of really have a place to sort of get together. But why don't we do something? right? Well, let's figure out what we could actually go do. And so Unify was proposed by many of the developers and consultants and volunteers of the NIC. And there's been literally hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of people who participated. And so Unify is that vision of saying, how do we demonstrate to the field this variety of perspectives on driving data interoperability and data exchange across the various silos? And I don't believe there was really, I don't think there has been an entity really focused on that in a kind of ecumenical way before the NIC got involved with that work. And so Unify really has come out of that in the last couple of years, has been a focal point for many people, including point of care partners who participated in some of the work as well. That really gave birth to the consent work and the stuff we're going to be talking about, which I can give a little more background on that. It's been a very interesting sort of development over a number of years to get to the point where we are right now.
I just want to add that I've had the opportunity to attend some of these Project Unify sessions, and it's been very informative, even to a guy like me who's been around the block and seen pretty much everything. But Daniel, I just want to point out a session that you had a few weeks ago where a local county agency was presenting their work at creating interoperability, allowing different human services and healthcare organizations to exchange data. And interestingly enough, and probably to no surprise to the people that are listening to this podcast, they said, well, our agencies don't even have a standard computer system. And so what we're working on is a standard form that we can fill out and at least share the information in a standard way among the different agencies. And we'll worry about the computerization of this form later. And I just thought that was interesting because it demonstrates the tremendous span of variability of these different agencies and their technological capabilities.
I also noted that your objectives here are not just to describe how complex this problem is and how we need solutions, but to do something about them. I think you refer to this as not just a think tank, but a think and do tank.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So we mentioned this term, social determinants of health, and I think with COVID now, another term is coming into focus, health equity. Could you unpack that a bit for us on what greater challenges there are there and who we're trying to serve more effectively?
Sure. Maybe let me give you a little context for it as well, because our focus on social factors or social determinants and equity really has grown over the last couple of years as we become more involved with what the impact of COVID had. So we've been holding a national conference, a symposium every year for the last 14 years, bringing together thought leaders. And we were preparing one for which would have turned out to be last January with a Stanford Center for Population Health Sciences. And of course, last year, right at the beginning of our planning efforts, that got put on hold because you could see early in February, late February, early March, that things were going to go sideways. So we rapidly sort of pivoted to create a virtual conference at the time. So we decided, you know what, this is just too much momentum. Things are going to get crazy here. We knew that early, everybody kind of got pretty aware of that. And so over the last year or so, we really worked with the NIC and the National Interoperability Collaborative to focus in on what we could do over COVID so that when we came out of the other end of that, we would be able to have something we could do, something we could offer the nation that might be in response to COVID. And so that's really the context for the consent work. And one of the key pieces that really emerged throughout our conversations, and we really worked pretty diligently over the year, bringing people together week after week after week after week. It was really an amazing experience. People referred to it as the interoperability support group during COVID because there were so many like-minded people. But one of the things that really stood out, not only for us, but many other people, is so many of the communities that were most affected by COVID and continue to be are, poor, Black, Brown, undocumented populations, and how, the ravages of COVID and the lack of services, the lack of access and transportation, the lack of providers in those communities really exacerbated the effects of COVID. We saw that through the disproportionate impact on minority communities. And that what really began to develop was that sense of how do we design for the future without having people who are the recipients of those services as part of the conversation, right? So we began to be very conscious about trying to integrate into our work people who have what is oftentimes referred to as lived experience in that area. And that really began to sensitize us to the kinds of solutions as sort of designers or developers or consultants would bring to the table would not always resonate with people in those communities. There's a concern around safety. There's a concern about privacy. There's a concern around my data. And so as we began to really involve people, slow the conversation down a little bit, bring in other voices in the conversation, you begin to hear those fundamental kinds of questions around trust. You know, can I trust the system, right, with my data? What's going to happen with it? Who's going to have access to it? How do I know it's going to be used appropriately? And so that began to be part of the conversation. And over the last few years, that has really exploded. And certainly in the current administration, the focus on equity is one of the first executive orders of the Biden administration to say equity first. We need to bring people to the table who are most affected by the disproportionate and the disequities in our systems.
Yeah. So let's get into this area of consent in more detail. Just published this very compelling and comprehensive report, 73 pages, I believe, called Modernizing Consent to Advance Health and Equity. It's a layered issue. Tell us a bit about how this report came about. And, it occurs to me, we used to say when health notes and doctors' information that about the patient was put out on portals and so forth, people could gain more control of their own health. Well, that'd be great if patients, had medical degrees. And I even wonder now with consent and so forth, if patients have to have, degrees in law. So how do you make this accessible to the folks who need it the most? But let's get into this consent. Tell us about the report.
So this is one of the more fascinating parts of my life over the last couple of years. As I described earlier, we held this virtual sort of conference preparation over the year, most of 2020 and early 2021, with this very eclectic group of participants, hundreds of people from across the country. The goal of that, as I said earlier, was to identify literally one or two things that we could do coming out of COVID that would actually have a structural impact on our safety net systems. It's an audacious idea. What could we do? As I said before, the world really doesn't need a whole nother set of recommendations, right? I mean, yeah, that's useful. It's important to know that, but we need some stuff we can go do. So our challenge to the group was a million problems and all sorts of unanticipated stuff we're going to run into. But what could we do that would really have an impact? And to my delight and my surprise and to many people's, through this iterative process, which really included social determinants, included a lot of the interoperability and technical and legal aspects, we distilled down the thinking to actually six recommendations. And one of those was the idea of consent. As a go-do, right? Something we could actually go do that would have very broad impact, not only on healthcare and advanced care planning and documentation and sharing your medical records, but every other area also sort of raised and waved the flag saying, man, if we want to share school attendance information or grades, you need consent. If you want to share, all sorts of any information that might be somewhat protected around social care or foster care or housing or nutrition or justice issues, consent is the hurdle. It is the blocker of really data sharing and interoperability. And that, interestingly, emerged as a result of this very, very intense process and really came out as like, wow, this is not only consistent across all of the areas, but it's actually something that if we could make a little change in this area, could actually have a tremendous impact on data sharing and interoperability. And I say that because we believe, and I think that there's a consensus now in the community that we recognize that there's a lot of factors that go into people's health and well-being, right? It's not just healthcare. You need your cardiothoracic surgeon when you need them, But the other 364 days, a lot of other stuff is happening around you. And so the question is, how do we get that whole person view? Well, it's through coordinated care. It's the ability for the right people to see the information about you so that they can make informed choices and decisions to help you and your family and your community, where you live in your community, to actually make progress. Because we know that just fixing one thing doesn't get us to the goal line, so to speak. But at the root of coordinated care is the ability for people to access information from different areas. And you can't do that today, really, hardly at all, across sectors without consent. All the attorneys will come down and say, great idea, love to be able to do coordinated care. If you just get me the consent, we're good to go. But everybody has been really looking at many of the other factors and not all the way to actually, how do you get obtained consent and allow it to be revoked? That is the idea that is really applicable very, very broadly. And we can get into that in a minute. But what was amazing is it resonated so strongly with everyone. And the attorneys and the leadership would say, well, if you got consent, then basically we're good to go. You know, you still need to define a lot of things, but it takes away so much of the friction that's really gumming up the works of data sharing right now. So it's very exciting in that regard.
Ed, you were involved in developing the report with Point of Care Partners. What would you like to add?
Well, I agree with Daniel that this is an exciting and very impactful area. And I think that we learned by surveying many different organizations that were involved in developing consent functionality, as well as talking to various programs. We learned about the breadth of this issue, the breadth of the potential positive impact of being able to tackle it and improve the functionality, but also the depth of the challenge. You know, from in the healthcare world, which Point of Care Partners spends most of its time in the healthcare and pharma arena, the issue of consent really revolves around consent to treat, consent to share data, which is otherwise known as privacy, which is a big part of this conversation, consent for advanced directives, how we want to be cared for in critical times of our own treatment when we might not be able to speak for ourselves, and also consent to participate in clinical trials. And so those are the healthcare main scopes of the whole consent function. But as Daniel points out, there's a lot more to that. There's a lot of other programs that impinge on, relate to our overall health that aren't actually in the specific healthcare arena. So we also learned a lot about the importance of those programs and how, you know, in some cases they can work collectively with the healthcare resources, but in other cases they're essentially might as well be in a completely different world. So I think this consent report, which Daniel is describing, is a very comprehensive and broad treatment and analysis of this whole area and a scan of what is happening around the country. I just want to point out one other point, and then I'll turn it back over to you guys, and that is that, you know, the regulatory aspects of this are very daunting because each state has different laws and regulations related to consent and how consent can be granted and acquired and when there needs to be notaries involved and other types of legal representation. And so, you know, a lot of this has to do with the diversity, especially if we're talking about people moving from program to program or healthcare system to healthcare system or state to state. A lot of times the consents that they've granted don't carry over to the next setting where they're receiving care or services.
Oh, wow. When you start talking about getting things notarized, what a challenge and hassle that is in our society. I think there's some ways that you can do it online now, although I haven't tried that. Daniel, what are some of the surprises that came out of the work you did on this comprehensive study?
Well, a number of things. And I think that I'm not sure what the right priority is, but one of the things in particular was just the consensus across all of the different sectors, everybody grappling with this issue. And they're grappling with it independently, and they're unaware, by and large, of other aspects, other jurisdictions working on the same problem. And so one of the things I've noticed and we've noticed over our efforts over the years has been the duplication and the reinvention of stuff that's happened. And as a result, we waste a lot of resources. It takes a lot of time because we're not able to build on other people's shoulders. And what we found was that there actually are some really promising things out there and that we were able to really identify them pretty rapidly. And I think get participation from the leading, or what we're calling the promising practices, to really describe where they're at so that from this point forward, we can build on the shoulders of the people who've come before us. And there's some really good work that's happened over the last, 10 years in particular, that the Office of National Coordinator really started thinking about this on the health side. And now it's beginning to bleed over into the social and educational and justice side of things. So that's one thing, is that there's really commonality. There's certainly commonality of interest. There are some very advanced things that are beginning to happen that we can build from, that there's a community out there that needs and is very interested in learning from one another. And as the topic we brought up just a little bit earlier around equity, is that there's also another side of this equation, which is we need to really temper our enthusiasm with being able to gather and share information with the people's data and information on behalf of whom we're working, and to really make sure that the voices of people who are involved with systems are part of it. Because we've learned some things like, slow down a little bit. Let me take this back to my family, what you're asking for, and make sure that it's settled, well within my community and within my family when I'm sharing the information, because it just doesn't affect me. It affects other people in my family. And that was something that was really quite striking and some work we were able to do with in the Bronx, one of the groups we were working with, really, who are close to the community, was really able to articulate in a very powerful way. And I think that's really part of a lot of what we're thinking about is how do we balance, sort of the enthusiasm of what's possible technologically with the reality of people's capabilities and interests and concerns in some ways.
Ed, any additional observations or surprises for you?
Well, I think that this whole area of equity, of getting consent from people who generate the data is about, it's their data, and gaining consent is, it's just a very interesting area. And it's one thing, as I've sort of said, to think about it from an engineering perspective or from a physician's perspective or from a scientist's perspective. You want all the data you can get and you want to be able to sort through it. But when you start talking to the people whose data it is, and of course we all sit in that seat, but we're, perhaps more empowered than a lot of people are to be able to command what happens to our data. But yet in today's world, our data gets out there and gets various places. So, I think it's an issue for all of us. But if you think about the settings that Daniel's talking about in the Bronx and in various underserved communities, there's just a lot of conversation that needs to happen. And it goes beyond just the technical aspects, and it goes to the aspects of trust and what's going to happen to this data. So I think for me, it just forcing me to think about some of these things and try to look at it from the consumer, the patient, the person who's receiving the service from the family's perspective was, an important revelation for me.
Yeah. One aspect of 21st century cures that got a lot of pushback was in this consent model for patient access. Once this information is in the patient's hands or in the hands of those organizations acting on behalf of the patient, is it really being protected? And is that all buried in the fine print of saying yes on these consent documents? How do you deal with a challenge like that? Do you guys have some thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to also add one other thought, which is, when you actually speak to people, they expect us to be sharing their information. While there's concern, generally speaking, people are a little aghast when they find out that we're not sharing the information, because generally they're like, hey, this is why you're asking me for the information for the 14th time. Get your act together, guys. So we need to be balancing those factors out as well. And who is actually inhibiting sort of the flow of information? Sometimes it's no disrespect, it's the attorneys who are trying to manage risk for the entities, the provider and the care payers, to make sure that that is, that they're maintaining the as low a risk profile as possible, and not sharing is less risky than sharing. So I just a little comment on that. Ed, did you want to add something?
I just want to reiterate what you just said, and that is, it's a scary thing when you have the information. If you're a care provider, if you're a care providing program, if you're a healthcare organization and you got data, you have data from your patients, you're obligated to act on it or to behave professionally based on that data. And if somehow you ignored it or ignore a major risk factor and don't act on it, that, you know, is a perceived liability. It's a little nuance that's an important nuance.
Ken, to your point before, what can we do, right? What are the options here in a way? And one of the things we've learned both from the scan report, which actually goes into some detail and provides a lot of resources and reference for people who want to go really deep into some of the sort of leading practices. Some of them have been, awardees of the Office of National Coordinator, the LEAP grants, some other innovative things out of the Baltimore, Virginia, D.C. area, the CRIS program, or the Bronx area, or the MIHIN area, with really looking at integration, is that we do have the capability to access the information. The technology is good enough, but we need to do it in a way that creates more uniformity in a way, so that we don't have the data out all over the place, but there's a trusted entity that can actually sort of be the traffic cop to authorize the flow of information based on roles and authentication of who you are, identity management, making sure you should have access to the information, and that the consent is in place to be able to say, you could share this information with this person for this purpose, for this period of time. And I think we've identified ways to do that. And we're looking at being able to actually develop some proof of concept demonstration models to actually demonstrate that. Because if we can demonstrate that, then we have potentially a replicable model that you can take from community to community that actually takes into consideration the variability of state laws. Remember, there's a federal floor. Many of the states have become, have created more, a higher bar for sharing information. But also importantly, we are able to learn from these proof of concepts and to be able to create almost a standard, sort of user interface written in a way that is understandable. And we would prove that it's understandable, so people are actually giving their informed consent without coercion. That's another important piece of the equation, is people want to make sure that, and we want to make sure that people don't feel coerced to give their information in order to be able to get access to services. So that kind of transactional nature is really important to build into that. But once you can actually demonstrate that, then I think that we can grow momentum very quickly around being able to move that and replicate that in other jurisdictions without asking everybody to do all of the heavy lifting, from the architectural design to the legal to all the technical aspects of it. So I'm really encouraged, if we can get this off the ground, be able to demonstrate some success.
Yeah, no, I understand you're doing work on standards for consent management, and it just seems like the industry could really benefit from that.
One comment about the report itself, which is, because speaking of heavy lift, the report itself's about, 60 pages long. It's a magnum opus of consent, in terms of scan and what's happening. It can be daunting. Not every one of our podcast listeners is going to have time to go through that report and every page and every element of the detail, but there's a 7-page executive summary of the report where you can really grasp what it's all about quickly and then dive into the details if you have time and the interest. So I think it's a very digestible report in that regard.
All right. Well, as we work towards wrapping up this podcast, Daniel, it's our tradition on the Dish to ask if there's anything you'd like to highlight or add, a call to action to the industry, to our listeners, and this is your chance.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity. Yeah, I'm encouraged actually by the interest by the federal agencies and by the foundation community to actually do this. This is resonating broadly across the country. Everybody I've spoken with, and I think uniformly, recognize that this could actually make truly a difference as we look at redesigning and as the federal dollars start to flow around these new infrastructure programs that are out there. It's the right time to make those kind of changes, and hopeful that through our efforts and our partners' efforts, that our federal partners at the ONC and CMS and ACF are at the table together doing that. And as I said, we're really hoping that this scan provides the impetus for people to get engaged, and we'll hopefully be able to share the unified links. So it's an open environment for people to participate at the whatever level they want. We have weekly meetings basically, and engage in the conversation. We'll be holding some additional webinars going into December and into the beginning of the year, really to discuss this more. And to people who want to engage directly or indirectly, we invite them in. It's an open process to participate and to learn. Materials all up on the web, and there's very low barriers of entry. And so we look forward to people engaging in this work and figuring out how to make it their own and bring it into their own communities, and ideally contribute back to the commons, because I know there's other stuff out there that we didn't find in our efforts. And to bring that together, we really want to make this report also a live document. We know the moment you publish something, it becomes out of date, there's new information. So we're trying to keep it open so we can continue to attract more information and more contributions. And so it becomes, not only useful, but also as current as possible out there.
All right. Thank you. Ed, a final thought?
I think this is a very interesting area of work for the people that are listening in to learn a little bit more about. And as to the Project Unify meetings and the various Stewards of Change Institute meetings, I just want to point out that it's not all work. It's a little bit of fun. Also, people like to interact. Daniel's a great leader for these sessions. So it's a good opportunity for people to get involved if they want to get involved in, not only do the work that we're all doing, but also get to know other people that have similar interests and want to make a difference.
Thank you, Ed. And thank you, Daniel, for taking time to speak with us in such an enlightening conversation. And thanks to our audience for listening to this edition of Point of Care Partners, the Dish on Health IT. If you're interested in the Modernizing Consent to Advance Health and Equity report we talked about multiple times in this discussion, you'll find a link to it in the podcast summary. It's free as a download, and be sure to give it a read. And as Ed mentioned, there's also an executive summary version. To get notified about our future podcast episodes, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use to pick up your podcasts, including our most recent new platforms, Healthcare Now Radio and the podcast channel. And if you prefer video, you can also watch our podcast discussion on the POCP YouTube channel. And remember, especially as the weather's getting colder now, Health IT is the dish best served hot. Thanks, everyone.
Is it a challenge to stay on top of interoperability regulations and the flurry of activity with fire accelerators? Email us at interopoutlook@pocp.com to learn more about our new Interoperability Outlook subscription monitoring service.